Okay. Here we go. I hope if I connected it. I forgot all my stuff here. Didn't even do anything. I thought I had it all done. So we're going to continue with cardiovascular pathologies. We'll get through as many as we can here. We have a little bit of catching up to do compared to normal. When last time I did it, we're just a little behind. We're not hugely behind, but we're a little behind now. So my question is, have you guys taken congestive heart failure in theory class? You talked about congestive heart failure in your massage theory class. Okay, so you have a sense of positioning and that kind of stuff, right? Which you need to be careful of. They need to be sitting up and so forth, right? So heart failure is a complex clinical syndrome that results from any structural or functional impairment of ventricular filling or ejection of blood. So that means you can have the right side affected, meaning the right ventricle, or you can have the left side defected depending on what's happened. Could be from a myocardial infarct, it could be from a virus, which is a cardiomyopathy, and so forth. So the heart is unable to pump sufficient blood to supply the body's needs. So that blood pressure that you're taking in the clinic with your patient at 120 over 80, the heart, if it's got damage to the muscular wall of the ventricle, it has a hard time developing enough pressure to get blood out to where it needs to go. So, you know, that 120 over 80 is what's required, or that 120 specifically is what's required for the ventricle to create, how much pressure to create so that blood can leave the ventricle and go out where it needs to go. It's a lower number, obviously, on the right side because it's low pressure going to the lungs. Failure typically develops and predominantly affects one side of the heart. It's either considered to be right-sided failure or left-sided failure. Quite often, it's a result of a myocardial infarction, where part of the muscular wall of the ventricle has been damaged and died, and therefore the ventricle's ability to be able to have a good contraction to pump blood out is very, very compromised. It can be a chronic disease over many years and is pharmacologically managed. Interestingly enough, back as early as 1992, I can remember patients with congestive heart failure who were not managed well at all. We managed them to some degree, but they didn't lead very well, good lives, and they ended up, I don't know what the mortality rate was at the time, but it was nowhere near the length it is now. Now, when you have congestive heart failure, you go to special clinics and hospitals where you're managed very specifically with medications to keep accumulation of fluids down, keep heart contraction strong, and so forth. And these people live much better and longer lives. In Canada, we use four classes, 1 through 4, and depending on whether there's no symptoms all the way to very severe symptoms when it's happening. So, you know, get a sense of that. So that maybe you see a patient with congestive heart failure or heart failure. You ask them where they're at, so they know what stage they are, and it gives you a sense of what kind of issues they're having or how significantly the disease is affecting them. Heart failure is a common complication of ischemic and hypertensive heart disease, more common in the older adult and quite common as a result of heart attack. Now, I don't know if I talked about this in hypertension, but you can actually get a hypertrophy of the heart when you have chronic, long-standing hypertension. Do you know what I mean by hypertrophy? Increase in size. But what happens in the heart, so if you have long-standing, uncontrolled hypertension, the backflow of pressure in the cardiovascular system will actually blow up your heart like blowing up a balloon. The heart will get enlarged. The thing that happens is, though, as the heart gets larger, the wall gets thinner and can contract well enough to pump blood out, so you can get heart failure from that. When I was taking my cardio course way back when I worked in the hospital, we had a pathologist who used to bring in a bucket of hearts, so he kept all the unusual hearts that he came across. And he had a heart that was the size of a cow heart. Have you ever seen the size of a cow heart? And it was out of a 90-year-old lady. It hypertrophied so large. It was like this. Imagine in your chest having a heart that big because her hypertension hadn't been managed well and it had backed up. And of course, that heart gets so thin it can't function anymore, and it leads to death eventually. Approximately 1 in 3 have at least one risk factor for heart failure. Hypertension is the most prevalent and the most modifiable risk factor. Diabetes mellitus and metabolic syndrome also can be risk factors. And of course, atherosclerotic disease can contribute to it as well, simply because, you know, that chance of an MI and damaging the muscular wall. Those with pre-existing heart disease are at a greater risk for the development of heart failure. So if they think that there's something going on that way, you'll have a test where you actually get an ultrasound of your heart, and they can actually measure how much the heart's pumping out, and you can actually hear it and kind of see it if you get a chance. It's kind of interesting to watch, where you hear whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Actually, you can hear the blood ejecting out of the ventricle. So how does this result? It comes from an index event and then develops into a clinical syndrome characterized by impaired cardiac function, in other words, declining heart pumping. The index event either causes damage to the myocardium or impairs its contracting ability. So there's some event that happens that really affects the muscle wall to be able to contract appropriately, and therefore you end up with this inability to move blood out. When we look at them, we can divide it into either right-sided failure or left-sided failure. You probably learned that in theory class. Did you talk about left side and right side? So we'll use the left side. So the heart fails to propel blood forward normally, and the body will use 3 neurohormonal mechanisms to compensate, but eventually even that becomes insufficient and you start getting this problem. The failing heart attempts to maintain normal cardiac output by enlarging the pumping chambers. So initially it works. So initially the hypertrophy actually does provide some degree of increased pumping ability to eject a greater amount of volume of blood out of the heart. But eventually what happens is the myocardial cells start to elongate further and further. And yes, you get this increased blood ejection initially, but then as the cells get longer and longer, they become weaker and weaker, shall we say, and accumulatively they just can't get a good, strong contraction of the ventricle to move blood out. So what happens is the first compensatory phase, the right continues to pump its normal volume into the respiratory circulation, and because the left ventricle is limited, blood starts to congest in the pulmonary circulation. And if this continues, the air spaces of the lungs actually flood with fluid that's leaking from the blood vessels. So picture, if you will, you've got the heart contracting, you have the right side, you have the left side. The right side is pumping blood into the lungs for gaseous exchange. And then the left side, of course, is pumping blood out through the aorta into systemic circulation to supply muscles and organs and so forth. If the left is unable to pump out appropriately, you start getting a couple things happen. You get the blood that's maintained in the chamber starts getting larger and larger, and within the context of that, pressure starts to move backwards. So where you had pressure that was going out into the aorta, into systemic circulation, because blood's not leaving and you're getting this accumulation and you're not getting a hard enough squeeze, the blood pressure that's existing as blood's coming down to the left atrial left ventricle, it starts to accumulate in backflow. So the pressure starts leaving the left ventricle into the left atria, out the left atria into pulmonary circulation. So you get this, shall we say, congestion of blood in the lungs because the left is unable to pump it out. So because of that, you get increased pressure in the vessels around the lungs, which starts to push fluids out of the capillaries into the path of least resistance, which is the actual spaces in the lungs themselves. Ultimately, people with left-sided failure drown. Is that fair enough to say? They drown. Their lungs literally fill up with fluid to the point that they can't have gaseous exchange anymore. And I can remember very distinctly with a gentleman, again, this is in the 90s, before how we managed it, and he was in end-stage congestive heart failure. And he was sitting up, and I had to do an ECG. And, of course, when you do an ECG, you want the patient as supine as possible. So without thinking, I just hit the button, and the bed started going down. And we didn't even get this gentleman flat, and he started coughing, and fluid was literally pouring out of his mouth, up out of his lungs. So I have to sit them back up again to maintain it. So you literally start just filling from the bottom up, and the lungs just start filling like a container with the fluid. And it's all fluid that's leaking out of pulmonary circulation. So, of course, they're going to be short of breath. The second compensatory phase, we have a sympathetic nervous system that responds to the increase the stimulation of the heart, of course, to increase pumping more times and force of contraction. So you get faster and stronger contractions to try to get the blood out. Well, what happens is, again, you get ventricular hypertrophy. So the muscular wall actually starts to thicken, right? No different than pumping iron and your bicep gets larger. So the myocardium gets thicker. And again, it's not so bad. It actually is able to pump stronger, but of course it needs more O2 because there's more of it. But what eventually happens, the coronary circulation can't meet the need of the increasing thickening myocardium, so therefore the patient ends up in angina. Because angina really is nothing more than the myocardium screaming for oxygen that it's not getting. So the patient ends up with angina. And then the third compensatory phase involves something called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. With less blood leaving the heart, less blood passes through the kidneys, and the kidneys then start retaining water, which can lead to kidney failure. Okay? So the whole system starts not doing well, right? Simply because the heart is unable to pump blood out. So we can see here we've got normal heart here with filling of the ventricles and then ejection of blood, in this case pulmonary circulation, systemic circulation. And then when we get to a ventricle that pumps out less than 40 to 50%, we can see here that, you know, we've got enlarged ventricles, they fill with blood, and we can see this enlarging that's happening here. And then as we move on into a greater amount of a dysfunction of the ventricles, because of this hypertrophy, they're thicker to pump more, but they get so thick they can't fill anymore. Do you remember Starling's Law? Starling's Law says, if things are working right, you get a preload, which means you get a small little stretch of the muscle, and if it's working right, the heart ejects as much blood out as it got in. But you have this little stretch and then the contraction. Well, because these are so thick, they can't expand, and Starling's Law really gets affected, so that lowers ejection out as well. Okay? And then you get this backflow fluid in there. So left-sided heart failure, this is the failure of the left ventricle to pump enough blood into systemic circulation. And because you've got blood coming from pulmonary circulation into the left, your backflow goes into the lungs, so they get pulmonary congestion. So it says results in pulmonary edema or disturbance in the respiratory control. Dyspnea can, but does not always correlate with the extent of heart failure. You get fatigue and muscular weakness due to the dyspnea, weight gain, and a faster heart rate with decreased exercise ability. Renal changes, and we see decrease in urine production, especially when the colon is upright. The kidney then secretes hormones, which results in vasoconstriction, which results in increased peripheral resistance and increased blood pressure, and you can see how the cycle is working. So what do? We give drugs, right? Diuretics to start peeing out more volume of fluid, right? We have to deal with these hormones, right, to offset for vasoconstriction because we don't want that and so forth. So we are managing it much better. We used to call heart function clinics is what we called them, and lots of people in there, and they do work very, very well. Now, mind you, some people do get such significant myocardial damage in a heart attack. We do the best we can. Now, right-sided heart failure, where's blood coming from to the right side? The body, right? The body overall. So, right failure, it can't pump blood to the lungs. So, this results in peripheral edema and venous congestion of the organs. The fluid commonly accumulates in the extracellular spaces of the periphery. And, of course, because we live in a world of gravity, where does it go? Down, mostly, right? So, this is why It's because of the gravity that gets in the legs. So usually symmetric and occurs in the dependent parts, of course influenced by gravity, where venous pressure is highest. So this is why most commonly it's in the feet and ankles, eventually up to the lower legs. You will see jugular venous distension that can be observed and is a result of retrograde fluid from the right atrium. So one thing you'll see is you'll see in these individuals their jugular vein is enlarged and you can see the distension right through the skin. By the way, did you guys see the gentleman who got his throat sliced in hockey? Did you hear about this? A young man died last week. He was playing in a hockey game. Yeah, and he got hit in a check, and as the checker was falling over, the leg came up, and down he went, and when he got up, there was blood all over the ice. It slit right through the carotids.
Yeah, I saw a video back in time.
Yeah, a long time ago, but there was one last week, and he died. He died. You could see he went down, and as he stood up, the blood just started spraying all over the ice. Yeah. So you can see here, the way to remember it, right, here's left side of failure here in the lungs, of course, and then right side of failure here. You know, we talk about the legs for sure because of gravity effect, but you also get accumulation of fluid in the abdominal cavity as well with ascites and so forth. So, and you can see this accumulation of fluid, the amount of stress that's placed on the renal system is phenomenal and starts shutting it down. So this is why, you know, your positioning is important in terms of dealing with treatments with these patients. Heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So a heart that has an ejection fraction of 40% or more, and 50% of heart failure patients have this. So when you have that, oh my goodness, the ultrasound you have on your heart. Echo. Jeez, thank you. At echocardiogram, what they're doing is they are measuring your ejection fraction. So they're looking to see if there's any compromise to the heart's ability to eject blood out. And an echo actually can measure the amount of blood that's coming every time the heart beats. And that's what that whoosh sound is. It's actually listening to the blood traveling out of the ventricle into the aorta, for example, right? And they can measure and see what percentage has been done. So, medical management. Is it right-sided or is it left-sided? An echocardiogram is the main tool. What happens is to prevent or to treat, you deal with the underlying causes. Exercise quantitatively achieve results similar to those attained with drugs. And that was fairly new to me when I read that. Because in the past, we used to say, yes, you want you exercising, but be very, very careful. We actually want these patients into exercising fairly. I mean, you're not doing HIIT and anaerobic work, but you're moving and grooving. Pharmacotherapy, ACE inhibitors are standard therapy to block that renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. Diuretics to control fluid buildup. Beta blockers are an effective therapy along with ACE inhibitors because they block the two neurohormonal systems, renin-angiotensin, aldosterone, and the sympathetic nervous system. So it's all about calming the heart down so that it doesn't get into this overextended hypertrophy and so forth. Treatment is difficult. Declines in mortality have been observed with associated treatments to risk factors, advances in pharmacological therapy, cardiac revascularization approaches, and pacemakers. So we're able to give people a much better elongated life after they've been diagnosed with heart failure. Or as I said, even just as long ago as 92, that patients were really, really struggling. And from a medical point of view, 1992 is not that far away, right? Not really that far away at all. Okay, orthostatic or postural hypotension. Have you heard of this before? Okay, so these are the folks that are lying down and they stand up and they get really dizzy and they can fall down, right? So they're not able to work with their blood pressures to maintain changes in posture. So it's a decrease of 20 millimeters of mercury or greater in systolic blood pressure or a drop of 10 or more in both systolic and diastolic blood pressure with a pulse increase of 15 beats per minute more on standing. So this is the, you know, patients who are lying down or sitting for long periods of time, they stand up and there's a big change. It's more frequently in older adults where they stand up, they have syncope where they're almost passing out, and then they end up falling down and hurting themselves significantly and end up in a merge, maybe a broken hip or arm or something like that. Cardinal feature of autonomic nervous dysfunction and non-neurogenic etiologies. The postural reflex is slow as we get older. So you actually have proprioceptors in your body that, as you move to stand up or change postures, sends messages to the nervous system, which then increases heart rate or does various things to help prevent this. As we get older, it doesn't work as well. So postural reflexes are slow. Older than 65, when we put on a table and tilt it, their stroke volume actually decreased. So just putting them on the table and tilting them, the heart wasn't able to keep up. Most commonly, this develops due to dehydration and medications, specifically diuretics and vasodilators, such as diuretics, calcium channel blockers, nitrates, L-DOPA for Parkinson's disease, and antidepressants. So quite often, the elderly person who has this problem isn't because they have a physical ailment, it's because the medications are affecting them too much. So, of course, time to the doctor, go see to review your meds. Is there anything we can change and work with, that kind of stuff? Can occur secondary to specific diseases such as endocrine disorders, metabolic disorders, and neuropathies. Alcohol and medications can cause autonomic neuropathies, leading to impairment of vasoconstrictive mechanisms. So it's a physiological stress related to upright posture. So normally when we stand up from seated or lying, the gravitational influences on circulation are compensated for by several mechanisms, including circulatory and autonomic nervous system interventions. So we're able to, once that posture changes, the body recognizes it through proprioception, makes the appropriate changes, and then we don't really note it in any sort of lessening of a cardiac output or anything. But as they say, as we get older, that gets slower and it gets a little bit behind. The gravity causes venous pooling in the lower limbs, a sharp decline in venous return, and reduction in filling pressure of the heart. The compensations are initiated by baroreceptors located in the aortic arch and the carotid bifurcation. So you actually have a proprioceptor right here where your carotid divides into the external and internal carotid. I've seen it massaged for tachycardia. I only saw it once in my entire career, and it worked like a charm. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen it before. And you got to get in there. It's not fun, but it works. You actually massage that baroreceptor, and the heart rate comes down. It's interesting. Clinical manifestations, dizziness, blurred vision, and syncope or fainting. And three main modes of presentation are falls or mobility problems, acute or chronic mental confusion, and cardiac symptoms. So you've got your mom or your grandmother, great-grandmother, and they're falling all the time. This has to be a consideration to see if that's what's happening as far as that goes, right? Medical management, there are several general and specific approaches. There's no curative intervention. Prevention is important, though, whenever the underlying disorder is corrected, symptoms cease. So if medications are a very common cause, then a review of medications and changing thus should lead to the diminishing of this problem. Okay, that's part two done. Let me know if you guys need a break too at some point. Part three. Then I believe we're done cardiovascular. So, myocarditis. What's that tell you? Right off the top. The name should tell you exactly what it is. What is myocarditis? Yeah, inflamed muscle of the heart. Right. So, it's uncommon. Can be acute or chronic inflammatory condition, usually as a result of bacterial or viral infections, but it can also include those causes of ischemic heart disease. Other causes include chest radiation, sarcoidosis, which is a lung disease, which we'll talk about later, and certain drugs like lithium and cocaine. Cocaine is brutal on the heart. It's a terrible drug on the heart. If you use it for a long period of time, that's why, I haven't said it yet, but what's his name that just died from Friends? Perry? Matthew Perry. He was a long-standing cocaine addict. And I wouldn't be surprised that if he had a massive heart attack in the hot tub, and that's why he died and drowned. Yeah. I saw it once with a 21-year-old. I knew the gentleman, and his mom and dad were rich, and he had these big parties all the time doing coke like mad. And Dr. Batt said basically his heart just went. Pfft. Yeah.
This is the same story. My neighbor back in India, 21-year-old, had his wedding planned a week after. family never lets me know, but I told my mom and dad, like, you know, 21-year-old still dying from heart attack.
Right. Yep. Those with systemic lupus have potential for lupus carditis, which makes sense, right? Because it's a connective tissue disorder. Heart's made of connective tissue, just like every other organ in your body. So there, some lupus people or those with connective tissue disorders can get cardiac involvement, which can cause inflammation of the heart muscle. Progresses through active healing and healed stages with infiltration of inflammatory cells. So all those things we talked about with inflammation. So you get interstitial edema, focal myocyte necrosis with replacement of fibrosis. So you get death of myocardial cells, and because myocardial cells are the nature of that tissue the way it is, do you remember parenchymal cells stoma cells. So in the cardiac muscle, there's no parenchymal cells. It's all stromal repair. So you get fibrosis, and then of course, then you're going to start seeing diminishing of heart function through the myocytes. The electrical system changes, which can cause ventricular tachycardias or tachyarrhythmias. Occasionally, can progress to dilated cardiomyopathy with left ventricular dysfunction, which can lead us to heart failure. Okay, usually resolves with treatment of the underlying condition, antimicrobials for bacteria, and meds to improve cardiac output and reduce arrhythmias for viral stuff. I was always taught myocarditis is a medical emergency, and you should go in, and they'll put you on IV antibiotics or antivirals to work with it as far as that goes. Right? Now, one thing that I've had the pleasure of doing is sometimes you have to do acentesis because you get fluid buildup. Yeah. And so I've actually assisted in one. They're fun to watch. Yeah.
When I was in college,
Well, do you know what we used to do? Sorry, you guys, you kind of understand this. So I would have to go into the cardio guy, okay? And I would put an alligator clip on the needle and run the ECG. If the needle touched the myocardium, it would just go nuts. And if you pulled it back, you'd get a normal ECG complex, and that's how the physician knew to pull back or be in, and then empty it all out. And so the funny story is the nurses were all busy in the ICU, and he's like, "You need to help me, Brian." And I'm like, "I've never done this before," but I had a sense of what a sterile field is and that, so, you know, we wash and everything. So we're set to go. He says, he's got a syringe, he goes, "I need a needle," and I knew, you know, you open up and just give the needle. Well, I was nervous. I went like this. The needle went up in the air and went back down again, right? And he's like, "Really, Brian?" I'm like, "Hey, this is my first time. I'm sorry." So you can see you get these inflammatory immune cells in here with the inflammation. Chest pain is common. It's not unusual for someone with an acute myocarditis to go in the hospital thinking they're having a massive heart attack, and the ECG won't really show that there's those kind of changes, and then they'll do lots of other tests, and then you're in the ICU for a couple of days. So cardiomyopathy. So this is a part of a group of conditions affecting the heart and its muscle, which results in the failure of myocardial performance due to mechanical or electrical deficiency, which usually exhibit ventricular hypertrophy or dilation. I will repeat, part of a group of conditions affecting heart muscle itself. This results in failure of the myocardial performance, and it's usually due to mechanical or electrical deficiency, and then you get ventricular hypertrophy or dilation. The causes are frequently genetic. Now, one thing I will say about cardiomyopathy folks are usually the only way you can deal with this is through a heart transplant. Usually cardiomyopathy does. You don't usually show up in the doctor's office until a significant amount of damage to the heart's already been done, and there's not a whole lot they can do for you other than to maintain the symptoms that you have and start looking for a new heart. Kind of surprised that Claire's not here, to be honest. Okay. So you have primary cardiomyopathy, which is just to the heart muscle. Genetic can be mixed, genetic and non-genetic, and acquired can be the causes. Genetic, you have what's called hypertrophic and arrhythmogenic right ventricular failure, left ventricular conduction system disease, and then acquired can be cardiomyopathy can result out of having myocarditis. Secondary, you get myocardiopathology as a result of a variety of generalized systemic disorders that affect the heart along with other organs. So it can be one way or the other. And you can see here, this is a cutaway heart that's had cardiomyopathy. How big do those ventricular chambers look to you? Not very big, right? Big, thick muscle walls, not much chamber. This is what happens, is those chambers get smaller and smaller. So you get, you get, you know, under normal conditions, you get, you know, you get these relaxed chambers, they fill up with blood, and through Starling's law, away the blood goes. Eventually, what can happen if you have dilated cardiomyopathy, the same as chronic hypertension, you start to get increased thinning as you get increased enlargement of the ventricles. This is myocardial hypertrophy to the point where there's no stretch anymore. You just have these tiny, tiny little chambers that can't do much of anything. They just become this big, thick myocardial heart. Incidents or risk factors can affect any age group and is often seen in young adults. So hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, it is an autosomal dominant genetic trait. In other words, it's built into your cells. It's your genetics and your DNA. There's not a lot that can be avoided with that. It's the most frequently occurring cardiomyopathy and the most common cause of sudden death in the young. So you might see, and you probably hear about this in the news once in a while, some athlete, male or female, they're at the level of the Olympics, in the middle of training, down they go dead. They're dead before they hit the ground. And they didn't realize that this was occurring in the heart at the time. Now, dilated cardiomyopathy is more common in third or fourth decade, and it's the one that's really related to heart transplantation. 20 to 30% of these folks have a genetic predisposition. The rest, we don't know why. Risk factors for this are long-term alcohol abuse, myocarditis, drugs, toxins, endocrine disorders, and errors of metabolism. Cocaine. All right? Okay, so it can lead to it. Restricted cardiomyopathy is you get myocardial fibrosis, so amyloidosis, sarcoidosis, hemochromatosis, too much iron, and hypertrophy. I have met patients with hemochromatosis. What a nasty disease. They're in pain all the time, and they just don't feel well. And these folks, you actually have to take blood away from them. You don't give them blood. You have to suck blood out of them. That's the only way they get feeling better. Peripartum cardiomyopathy is rare. It's a dilated form and can appear during the last month of pregnancy or the first 5 months afterwards. Usually resolves within about 6 months. And then there's chemotherapy-induced cardiomyopathy. It's a complication of cancer therapy. Astrocyclines are the major cause. I did have a doctor that I worked with for many years, Dr. Sriharsha, and he was in internal medicine. And he had lymphoma, and this is what eventually got him. Because of all the treatments that he had, it just affected his heart so significantly. What a nice man he was. He spoke better English than English people did. Yeah, he did all his training in Australia, and then he came to Canada. Sri was a great guy. He actually had bone marrow transplants, and he didn't stop working. He would go and he would work around the floors in his wheelchair. And still a doctor. The silly bugger, though, he went down to the U.S. without any insurance. He had a heart attack down there. And he made his family throw him in the back of the car and drive him across the border and bring him to Hamilton before he went to the hospital because he had no insurance. So here you go. So here you've got your normal heart. You've got hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. You can see the thickening of the ventricular walls. Here is restrictive cardiomyopathy. So the heart is restricted. It's tight. It can't open. And then you have the exact opposite. You have dilated cardiomyopathy. The heart is dilated, the walls are very thin, they're not very strong, and you can see here that, you've got interventricular septum here is a bit thickened, you've got a ventricular dilation here, so you have the strengthening, but then eventually what happens is And so in the dilated, you do have some stretching and stretching and stretching to get thinner. And then in the hypertrophic, you can see you just get excessive wall thickening, and it's not stretchy, and it just can't pump blood out much anymore. So cardiomyopathy, the pathogenesis is generally the same as for heart failure. The exact cause is really kind of unknown, but obesity causes an increase in total blood volume and cardiac output due to the high metabolic nature of adipose tissue. Severe cases, left ventricle dilation, increased left ventricular wall stress, and left ventricular diastolic dysfunction. So do you remember my calculation? For every pound overweight you are with fat, how much extra blood vessels do you have? A mile. For every pound of adipose tissue over your normal, you're putting 1 mile of work on the heart to add. So if someone's 500 pounds, imagine all that extra blood has to travel, the heart eventually can't do it. It's too much, it's too hard on it. Clinical manifestations, very similar to heart failure, dyspnea, orthopenia, tachycardia, palpitations, peripheral edema, and distended jugular vein. It's exactly the same. Now, the hypertrophic is frequently asymptomatic, with sudden death being the first sign that you've got a problem. Okay? Medical management, diagnosis requires exclusion of other causes, catheterization, echocardiography, chest radiography, blood chemistry, genetic mutation analysis, and ECG. ACE inhibitors and beta blockers are for the hypertrophic and the dilated forms, and then calcium channel blockers for reducing exercise intolerance. Prognosis, 75% of persons diagnosed with idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy are dead in 5 years, unless they can get a new heart. Right? And those with hypertrophic can lead to a long, relatively normal life with medical management. Okay? But again, quite often you don't know you have it until it's quite advanced. I can't remember what this is. I think it was kind of cool. This was just for those, because, you know, quite often I get bodybuilders in here in massage therapy, and anabolics and cardiomyopathy in a bodybuilder. There's now some significant correlation of this. Now, I have, because I did lots of triathlons and long-distance running in that, I've had an echo, and my septum was thick compared to the other parts, but never enough to worry about. But, yeah, these are the men and women who lift, you know, considerable heavy weights, and the pressures that are created and the heart's reaction to it. So it might be a good read to have for it, because it's quite interesting that there is this correlation. Again, I usually do it because there's usually, you know, in massage therapy, there's almost always bodybuilders. I don't know why it always goes back to the first page. Okay, congenital heart diseases. Do you guys want a break for 10 to pee or anything? Are you good? Okay. So, a congenital heart disease is an anatomic defect in the heart that develops in utero during the first trimester and is present at birth. So, basically in Canada, on average, 1 in 100 to 150 births, a child does have something that's not quite right in the heart. Now, in the last 30 years, we've been able to create many, many techniques, surgical and otherwise, that allow children to survive into adulthood with corrected or even uncorrected anomalies. So we do with it quite well. And many of these new techniques that we use for kids, do you know where they all came from? Toronto Sick Kids Hospital. A lot of them have come out of there, a lot of the new techniques. These congenital heart diseases have genetic causes with well-known chromosomal anomalies and account for 9 to 18% of all cases, with de novo, which is the most extreme form of rare mutations, accounting for another 10%, and the rest either unknown or involve lots of multiple factors, such as mom having alcohol consumption, smoking, air pollutants, maternal rubella, preeclampsia, folate deficiency, and diabetes. So they're kind of can be related to those. The heart begins to form from a tube-like structure during the fourth week, and the tube then continues to develop its chambers, septums, and valves as it moves along. Okay? Anything that interferes with this process in the first 8 to 10 weeks can result in a congenital defect. And if you think about it, how many women know they're pregnant in the fourth week? Not very many. And if they're continuing to party, do drugs, whatever, you raise the potential of this happening. So congenital heart disease, the cyanotic types, that means that, you know, the child looks blue on birth. Something called the transposition of the great vessel. When we look at transposition issue, there is no communication between the systemic and pulmonary circulation. So the pulmonary artery leaves the left ventricle and the aorta leaves the right. What's wrong with that? Vera, what's wrong with that? It's backwards. So the aorta should be leaving the left side and the pulmonary artery should be leaving the right side. Well, they flipped. The aorta is on the right side and the pulmonary vessels are on the left. So they were created backwards. Okay? So what's the problem with that? What might be a problem with that? Let's think of pressures. For a short time. But pressures. Right side is high or low pressure? Right side, is it high pressure or low pressure of the heart? No, just the pressure side. On the right side of the heart, is the blood at high pressure or low pressure? On the right side. Right. And on the left, it's? So what happens when we flip it? So you've got the left side pumping high pressure blood into the lungs. What's going to happen? Edema and all sorts of things, just like heart failure, right? So they can't live for long. So they have to have surgery.
Yeah, the right circulation will always have oxygenated blood.
Yep. That's right. So the body gets affected as well. Okay, so survival requires communication between the two circuits, right? So that we see here. Here is your where are we here? That's a tetralogy. Here's your transposition here. See? So you can see it's backwards. This aorta should be going here into the left ventricle and the pulmonary artery should be going into the right. So you've got a problem here because you can see that there's blood's just gonna travel in the wrong way and then the mix of oxygenated and deoxygenated gets backwards as well. Okay? Tetralogy of Fallot, four classic defects. So tetralogy means four, right? So pulmonary stenosis, large ventricular septal defect, aortic communication with both ventricles, and right ventricular hypertrophy. So here we see we have a huge defect between the right and left ventricles, meaning that blood can mix back and forth, which we don't want. We can see the aorta is sharing with both of them here. We have a real narrowing here of the pulmonary valve of the proximal pulmonary artery. And then we have significant thickening of the right ventricular wall. This right here is the tetralogy of Fallot. And I can tell you, surgery to fix this is slick as you can imagine now. They literally take a newborn out of mom, and right there when that child is only 7 or 8 pounds, they have open heart surgery and it's fixed right then and there. And yeah, it's pretty cool. Very successful now. Very successful. So I've done ECGs on, 8 or 9 or 10 year olds and go, why have you got a scar there, right? Because they had open heart surgery when they were first born. So, something also called the tricuspid atresia. This is failure of the tricuspid valve to develop with a lack of communication from the right atrium to the right ventricle. So that tricuspid valve, do you remember? Got to try it before you buy it. So then you have a problem here, right? So there's no tricuspid valve here. That's a real problem, isn't it? You can't get any communication between the atria and the ventricle. And believe it or not, like if I go back here, one in 100 kids. That may seem like a large odd. That means there's children being born with one of these pretty much every day. Well, just in our country, if you do the whole world, hundreds of them every day. It's very common. So those are the cyanotic ones. So these are the ones that affect how much oxygenation the child does or does not get. Then there's the acyanotic, and they're a little bit different. These are basically a lot of, the first two are septal defects, and the other ones are sort of having to deal with blood vessels leaving or coming to the heart. So ventricular septal defect, this is an abnormal opening between the right and left ventricles. It can go from small, like a pinhole, to quite large or no septum whatsoever. And then the same thing with atrial septal defects. Remember, we have a normal opening between the right and left atria when the baby's inside mom. Do you remember that from first semester when I talked about it? Right? Remember, it was called the foramen ovale. And then after birth, it's supposed to close, right? So you can imagine the potential for it not closing. A lot of kids probably suffer from it. I did, but it closed over. So abnormal opening between the right atria, allowing blood from the higher pressure left to flow into the lower pressure right. So when you've got either of these, you can see you get mixing of blood. So the child is never properly oxygenated. They have a little color to them, odd color. They're lethargic because they've got enough blood to kind of hang around, but not enough to really get things working normally. The next one is called coarctation of the aorta. This is narrowing near the insertion of the ductus arteriosus, and this results in increased pressure proximal to the defect, so head, upper extremities, and decreased pressure distally, body, lower, and extremities. So these kids get really high pressures up here and really low pressures down here. So here we can see, here's your septal defect here of the ventricle, which we can see here, right? It's what's going on. And then we can see here that, you know, this is the normal heart. Here's a ventricular septal defect. We talked a little bit about an atrial septal defect that we can see here. So you'll have oxygenated blood under high pressure mixing with the blue blood, deoxygenated blood. So at no point are there pure, full, nice oxygenation of the blood. And then you can see here is a coarctation that you can see here. So a really tight narrowing of the aorta. And the way the artist has done it here is these vessels, which will supply the head, neck, and upper arms, you will get high pressures here because of the narrowing. And then below the coarctation, down here in the abdomen, the lower limbs, you'll take a blood pressure, and the blood pressure is actually very, very low because it's so squeezed off. Patent ductus arteriosus. This is failure of the fetal ductus arteriosus, which is a vessel between the aorta and pulmonary artery, to close within the first few weeks postpartum. And this allows blood to move from high pressure to low pressure, so aorta to pulmonary artery. I didn't really spend time on this when I was lecturing in semester one, but it actually becomes a ligament that sits between the pulmonary artery and the aorta, kind of holds them in place. And when the baby was inside mom, that wasn't a ligament, that was actually a blood vessel, that there was some exchange of blood from the right and left side, which was a requirement. Because if you remember when I talked about in semester one, there's one key thing missing in a fetus, the reason why we need to mix blood. Do you remember what it is? Lungs aren't taking in any oxygen. That's, you know, we can kind of almost bypass lung tissue in a fetus because they're not breathing air in or oxygen. So I don't know if I have a picture of it here. There it is. So here you can see here, which just becomes a ligament outside of mom, and you can see it here called the ligamentum arteriosum. In fetal development, it was a blood vessel, and in this case, the child maintains this blood vessel, and they have to go in and they give it a little snip off, and away they go. Oh. Wow. That's it. Crazy. Okay, very cool. Had no idea. Didn't know that. And then there's something called congenital aortic stenosis, and this is the heart valve itself. So you can see here, you've got three leaves here in a normal aortic valve. Here there's only two, and because of the two, it's very narrow. And you can see in here. Now, what's very cool about these septal defects, ventricular or atrial, and something like this is aortic stenosis, the physician can hear them. So when they put the stethoscope on the chest wall, you hear whoosh sounds or clicks or all sorts of things. This is why a cardiologist has a really, really expensive stethoscope. Man, they're expensive. Yeah, but Lippmann's plus, plus, plus.
Yeah,
they
have different cardiologies.
Yeah, yeah. And literally they'll listen around. I had a murmur as a child, and so I went through the whole thing. I've been tested as a child and turned out to be. The rule is, the louder it is, the smaller it is. Septal defects. Yeah, the louder the sound, the smaller the defect. Think of putting water through a hose. If it comes through the hose, you don't hear much. If you put your thumb over the hose, you can hear it go shh. Same thing with defects. So it's cool. So the most common signs and symptoms include cyanosis and signs of heart failure. So you can have heart failure, pulmonary edema, pneumonia, hypoxia, sudden death, often a risk of bacterial endocarditis and pulmonary vascular obstructive disease later in life if it's not managed well. But honestly, as much as we talk about it now with the new techniques and that, these children go on to live pretty much completely normal lives. But here's a general rule. I don't know if it was said to you and you when you went to school, defects always come in threes. So my girlfriend, a friend of her daughter's, the child was born with a small hair lip, and I said, there's two more somewhere. I don't know what the rule of threes is in the human body, but do you believe in the rule of threes?
So, yeah, you're right. I mean, most of these are polygenic.
Yeah.
So they manifest in more.
Right. So it doesn't mean they're all serious. It just means you will find something unusual in the child's physiology or body where it was made different or it didn't quite come together properly or whatever. So when you start to see some of these congenital heart diseases, you sometimes have to look to see if there's something else going on. It may not even affect them at all, just kind of there. Medical management, identification, and genetic mutations. So that's usually done through mom prior to deciding to have children possibly. Would it be fair to say if mom has a congenital heart disease, is it somewhat probable? Yeah, yeah. Detected in utero with the ultrasonography. So, and there is some techniques that baby's being operated on while it's inside mom developing. They actually go through the abdominal wall into the uterus and actually do surgery on the fetus before it's even born. That I'd like to watch. That would be quite cool. I'd like to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's crazy. When prenatal diagnosis does not occur and when there's no symptoms initially, cardiac anomalies can remain undetected for years and even decades. So atrial septal defects have non-symptomatic symptoms. For 30 years, and then eventually develop atrial fib and supraventricular tachycardia because it was there. So it's one of those things that there's no predisposing symptomology, so nobody ever thinks to look until eventually maybe you end up with an arrhythmia of some kind, and when they do a normal workup, they go, oh, you have a septal defect. Didn't even know you had it. Okay. Clinical diagnosis begins with detection of signs and symptoms, auscultations, which, of course, as you now know, is listening to the stethoscope, and detection of heart murmurs themselves. Arrhythmias. So, when we look at the heartbeat does what? The SA node initiates a signal, and then you get atrial contraction, and then you hit the AV node, and then travels into the ventricles, and then you get ventricular contraction, right? So, that whole pathway of bum, 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 that's your normal kind of rhythm. So we're talking about when it goes different. So we say the heart rate is normally controlled by the sinoatrial node which is in an area, of course, in the upper right portion of the right atria. The signal then travels through the heart's conductive pathway, so it first goes into the AV node, then the bundle of His, I don't know why I have A there, apologize, bundle branches, and then the Purkinje fibers. So that's the normal way it goes. An arrhythmia is any disturbance of the heart rate or rhythm caused by an abnormal rate of electrical impulses or action potentials by the SA node or abnormal conduction of those impulses. So you can get all kinds of variations in there where you start to see things not having a nice rhythm, shall we say. They're classified according to their origin as either ventricular or supraventricular. So if they're arising out of the ventricles, of course they'd be ventricular. Anything above the ventricles is supraventricular. Do you remember the ECG complex? Do you remember that? So remember that you had this, right? Okay. Anything here is supraventricular. Anything here is ventricular. Okay. So anything that involves P wave is supraventricular. So that's representing the atrium. Anything in here is considered ventricular in nature. The QRS complex and the T wave is considered to be below or ventricular. So anything that's going on here would be considered supraventricular. Arrhythmias can vary from mild, asymptomatic, such as a sinus arrhythmia, to catastrophic ventricular fibrillation, which means you're on your way to die because the ventricle is just kind of wiggling like a bowl of jelly. It's not really doing anything. And of course, when we have, what we have to think about is when we think about this whole pathway of SA node to AV node, bundle of His, bundle branches, and Purkinje fibers, the whole purpose of these steps is to ensure that when the heart ejects blood, it's done efficiently. Any change in the patterning can lower cardiac output, okay? So, pathogenesis and clinical manifestations. Of course, the average beats per minute is anywhere between 60 to 100, and an arrhythmia is any significant deviation from this up or down. So you can have arrhythmias that can get lower than 60, and you can get arrhythmias that can get higher than 100, okay? There's two basic types. You have tachycardia, high arrhythmias, and bradycardia, low rhythms. Tachycardia is any arrhythmia greater than 100 beats per minute and can occur due to sympathetic influence. So, you know, your heart rate can go up if you're afraid and you have pain or emotional stress, exertion or exercise, ingestion of artificial stimulants like caffeine, nicotine, and amphetamines. So they can cause this increased rate, right? So you can see it's up. You know, you go to the doctor, you got a test and you're a bit nervous about it, your heart rate's going to go up a little bit. Bradycardia is heart rate anything less than 50 beats per minute. It is normal in well-trained athletes and common in those taking beta blockers. So my resting rate is about 48 because I work out. But I have a rate of 48, but if you took my blood pressure, it's 120 over 80. That's the key difference. Because what happens is if someone has a less than 50 beats per minute arrhythmia, you might see their blood pressure start to go down, okay? Organic disease of the SA node can cause bradycardia that is pathological. Think of it this way. You've got your SA node at the top, so imagine you have a heart attack in that area of the heart, that SA node can be affected, and therefore it's going to affect the whole pathway and be a problem. But here's the other thing. You know, when I draw a picture of a heart, like this, and of course, we have our SA node is kind of up here, right? Okay. And it races the pace, which we've talked about a couple of times. The thing to remember, though, cardiac muscles are autorhythmic, which means that they can create their own action potentials, which means that although the SA node and the AV node are what's important to the normal function of rhythm, other areas of the heart can control pace. So they're called ectopic centers. So although the SA node is here, you can initialize contractions anywhere else in the atria, for example. So So it could arise at any one of these, which is going to change the P wave. You've all heard of atrial fibrillation, right? Atrial fib means all of these are going off at the same time. So you're getting all this stuff. If there's damage done to this area of the heart, you can actually get ectopic centers and the heart beats backwards. So the ventricle beats first and then the atria. As a general rule, the farther you get away from the SA node, the slower the rate. So you can get a ventricular ectopic area that's controlling rate, but it's going to be in the 40s. Right? So the farther away you get, the lower the rate goes. See, this stuff I can talk with even looking at a book. I did this my first 10 years of my life. So when symptoms or complications arise, atropine or a pacemaker can be used. So sometimes a drug can be used, but you get into these, like that was my grandfather's problem. He had a heart, my great-grandfather's problem. He had a heart attack many, many years ago, like in the 50s, and he was one of the first Canadians to get a pacemaker, which changed his life because he was able to, his left ventricle would, or right, I can't remember which one, would control rate, but he'd get in the 40s, 30s and 40s, and he'd pass out. He'd be on the toilet having a bowel movement, and he'd pass out. So they put a pacemaker in, boom, kept the rate at 75 beats a minute, and they put the unit up here in the top part of the heart, and you get nice efficient contractions and change his life forever. Before he got his pacemaker, you know what his cardiologist told him to do? Every time you're feeling a little bit woozy, have a cigarette. Because it causes tachycardia, right? The nicotine causes tachycardia just to help him get along. So he smoked. Rhythm. So there are variations from normal rhythm of the heartbeat that are detected when they become symptomatic or discovered during cardiac monitoring. And as I said, they can be dangerous because they alter cardiac output. Remember, following the appropriate steps from SA to AV to bundle of His to bundle branches to Purkinje's is what makes the heart most efficient. Many types of abnormal rhythms are usually classified according to their origin, whether atrial or ventricular. So the first one we're going to talk about is atrial fibrillation. And the reason it's important is because it's a pandemic. Anybody over the age of, what did I say, 80? Pretty much now, has AFib. It just seems to be becoming, because we're living so long, we're starting to see it more and more and more and more in the elderly. So you're going to come across it. And they're going to be medicated for it. Okay? So, it's the most common type of supraventricular tachycardia or chronic arrhythmia. It's also known as paroxysmal supraventricular tachycardia or paroxysmal tachycardia. You don't see these terms much anymore. Pretty much it's called what it is atrial fibrillation is what you're going to hear. It's rapid, involuntary, irregular contractions of the atria, which is quivering or fluttering. Now, it does affect ventricular filling, because if you remember what happens is, again, Starling's law, right, that the mitral valve opens up, the tricuspid valve opens up, and blood leaves the atria and goes into the ventricle. Then the atria contracts, and via Starling's law, you get a slight stretch to the ventricle, and the blood goes when the ventricular contracts, right? Well, when you have AFib, this isn't contracting. This is just jiggling like a bowl of jelly. So that last little contraction of overfilling the ventricle doesn't function properly. But please remember this. The majority of blood that fills the ventricle is passive. Remember that? Bicuspid valve or tricuspid valve, the way it fits, when it opens up, it's like taking the floor out of a room and all the blood will empty out of the chamber, right? So it does affect cardiac output, but not at dangerous levels. There is a danger to AFib, which I'll talk about in a second, but because fill is relatively passive, it doesn't affect cardiac output too significantly, right? Blood remains in the atria, so you have less ventricular filling. Quite often occurs as a secondary arrhythmia associated with rheumatic heart disease, dilated cardiomyopathy, atrial septal defects, hypertension, mitral valve prolapse, hypertrophic cardiomyopathies, and post-surgery after an MI. That happened to a friend of mine. He had a valvular change done in the summertime, and he got AFib, which is finally settling down. The heart didn't like the valve surgery, and it got really irritated. But now he's fine. Thanks. Okay. It is considered secondary to cardiac disease. People with AFib, though, are prone to blood clots. because of this stagnant blood in the atria. Remember, blood doesn't like to stand still. If blood stands still, it clots. So if you have this constant remaining stagnant blood in the atria, there's a potential of its clot going, and where's that clot going to end up? Either in the brain or in the lungs, right? Because that's where they're off to when they're leaving. It's the most common arrhythmia in Canada. It's estimated that 200,000 with 1 in 4 of all strokes as a result of AFib. So we now know, my mother just got diagnosed with it. She's on Coumadin, which is really unfortunate because she has no money. So she's on the cheaper version, whereas my dad has some money and he's on one of the newer drugs. Coumadin's a pain in the ass because she's got to get her INRs done all the time, every week and all that stuff. But still, they want to prevent those clots. Incidence of atrial fib in Canada is up 4.5 per year, with lifetime risk estimated at 25% among those older than 40 years. Our population, aging population, is getting larger. Therefore, we're seeing a significant increase in atrial fib. Now, they do other things too, by the way. A neat treatment is they'll do what's called an ablation. And they'll take a device and go up the arm or in the femoral artery, and they'll go in here with a little laser and go, and kill all these little beats, areas here, to try to maintain just the SA node. It is a really cool test to watch, because when they set them up and they look at it on the monitor, you can see all the areas where the action potentials are originating, and they just take the laser and just zap those little areas. So you can see here, remember your P wave, your QRS, and your T. What you're seeing here is all these little P waves just going bang, 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 bang. And because they're so irregular, your ventricular contractions become irregular as well. Because let's say there's 15 action potentials a second, only one's getting through to the AV node irregularly to cause a ventricular contraction, right? So that's kind of the classic. Medical management, of course, accurate diagnosis of all these arrhythmias is made with an ECG. It's the most common, and often a 24 to 48 hour Holter monitor reading, where you wear a device for a couple of days that records every single heartbeat in that period of time. And some brain dead individual like me sits in front of a screen and watches every single heartbeat for 48 hours. It is mind numbing. It's mind numbing. But it's really cool when you get used to it. It's like rhythm. It's like watching music, and you just can see what, and you bring it back and go, oh yeah, it's not following the rhythm, right? As far as that goes. I once had a lady, I was watching her hold her monitor, and I locked, I stopped on what? And because you look at it quite small, so I zeroed in. She went 40 seconds without a heartbeat. And in her diary, she put, was in the hot tub and felt really dizzy. She's lucky she didn't freaking die. Just, you think it, maybe a lead fell off, right? You just double check. I brought the cardiologist in. He's like, call her in. So she, I don't know whatever happened to her. But pacemakers. So we have, these are implants designed to replace heartbeat by using a battery-powered device, which stimulates the myocardium through electrodes in contact with the heart. Have you guys ever seen a pacemaker? So back when my grandfather had one of the first ones in Canada, it was about the size of a large package of cigarettes. And it was in his abdomen. So you get this square here. It is now no bigger than a toonie. And the batteries, like, go forever. And you literally can make any alterations just by putting a device on the skin. And the specialist can get on the computer. In fact, they can even do it over the phone now. They actually can do it that way. So they're quite tiny. And they're transcutaneous. So you can see them. They just sit above the chest wall. Usually on the left. I don't know why they always choose the left. Yeah, maybe. So they literally go in, they make an incision, and they have a wire that has like a fish hook on it, and they shove it in the myocardium. Most cases, depending. The old ones used to always be in the ventricles. I don't know why. I guess because they thought it was a thicker wall. But the newer ones are going into the atria. But it just hooks and goes into that myocardium, and then it just uses battery stimulation to control it, as far as that goes.
Yeah. So they, the first day they wanted me to go and cut the wire. So I opened the drape. The patient had a coiled blue wire here. And the nurse was standing right here, like, nurse, what am I supposed to do? She's like, pull the wire. And I'm pulling the wire out of the chest of the patient. And at one point, it stopped. She's like, cut it.
Yeah. When I was at massage school, one of the teachers, Peter, he had a pacemaker. He was only in his 30s, so he had something congenitally wrong, but he had a pacemaker. So we had a big class, about 80, and he always wanted me to do class on Monday. He's like, no, Peter, I'm not doing class. You do it. So he's standing there, and he takes his shirt off to show, you know, his pacemaker, because it's obvious. You can see it. Sort of sticks out under the skin. So he says to the class, he goes, what kind of changes in your techniques would you do if you saw a patient with one of these? And you're like, I don't know. And I'm like, just avoid it. You just don't touch it. That's all. You don't affect anything. You can work the pecs. It doesn't do anything. So he says to one of these, who would like to come up volunteer? So this young girl goes down. He said, I'd like you to touch it. She's like, what? He's like, just come over and touch it so you have a feel in the skin. She touches it, and he pretends to pass out, and he falls to the ground. She starts crying. I'm laughing my head off because I know it's done absolutely nothing, right? He realizes his mistake and he jumps up and he's like, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. She was shaking. She thought she killed him. I thought it was funny as hell. So these pacemakers can be used in the treatment of slow heart rates, bradycardias, heart block, in life-threatening arrhythmias such as ventricular tachycardia or VFib. You get an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. So this is those who get you've got AFib up here where you get a jiggly atrium. Down here you can get ventricular fib where the ventricles get jiggly, and that's life-threatening. You will die from that. So what they do is if someone gets into this, the implanted pacemaker sends a jolt of electricity, just like the paddles you see in the movies, you know, boof, and they jump. Does the same thing in the heart and restarts it. So when I worked at the hospital, I would say it probably saved 15 or 20 people's lives easily. They said it's terrible because you're sitting there and it's just like some horse kicks you right in the chest, but then you're fine. So, valvular disease. So this is impairment of heart valves that can be caused by infections, such as endocarditis, congenital deformities, or disease, such as rheumatic fever and coronary thrombosis. They are classified as functional, stenosis or insufficiency, or anatomic, prolapse, congenital deformities, and deformities caused by rheumatic fever, trauma, infection, ischemia. So you can have functional valvular problems or anatomic. Stenosis, of course, is narrowing or constricting that prevents the valve from opening fully and may be caused by fibrosis, scarring, or abnormal calcium deposits on the leaflets. So stenosis always means narrowing. Insufficiency, also known as regurgitation, this is when the valve does not close and you get backflow into the heart chamber. And it, on auscultation, it actually sounds, it's gurgly. You actually can hear it as a gurgle. A prolapse, this is something that affects the mitral or tricuspid valves and occurs when you get large leaflets that bulge backwards into the atrium. So let's do mitral stenosis first. So mitral, where's the mitral valve? What's that? Right side? Left side. It's the most often a sequelae of rheumatic disease and primarily affects women. Usually there's a history of rheumatic fever not there, but you're a woman. Because the valve is thickened, it opens in early diastole with a snap that is audible on auscultations and then closes slowly with a resultant murmur. So you get a click. You get this kind of unusual sound. I really wish we had, you can get little things you could listen to. Yeah, they're kind of neat. In moderate stenosis, they get a bit of shortness of breath and fatigue. In severe stenosis, you get left ventricular pressure that becomes high enough to cause pulmonary congestion at rest with reduced cardiac output and resulting dyspnea, fatigue, and right ventricular failure. This is what my friend just had done this summer, and I've known he had the problem now for 5 years, and on his echo, it was significantly starting to get left ventricular pressure getting too high, so they decided to do the surgery. And he had a non-invasive type where they went in through, they made a cut. Yeah, they made a cut through the between the intercostals, deflated the lung, and went in across that way. So, it's kind of neat. Sorry. So you can see it here. Here you've got your normal valve here, and you can see the narrowing of the mitral valve here. Okay, open a normal, and then the mitral stenosis you can see here. And you can actually see it here. This is an echo, and you can see the left ventricle, left atrium, and then you can see the pulmonary valve is here, and the mitral valve is here, and you can see how it's kind of got a big opening there, and that's where you're going to get the regurgitation. Regurgitation is found in 1.7% of adults, occurring at about a 0.5% at age 18 to 44, 9.3% at 75 or older. So obviously, aging probably plays a pretty significant role on it. Ischemic heart disease accounts for pretty much half of all that. Secondary causes can possibly be dilated cardiomyopathies, rheumatic disease, collagen vascular disease, rupture of the chordate tendinae, and rarely a cardiac tumor. And on that bucket of hearts that I saw from the coronary, the coroner, he actually had a heart with a tumor. It's actually very, very rare to get heart cancer, but this individual did unfortunately have it. It's independently associated with female gender, lower body mass index, and older age. Everybody know what a body mass index is? In other words, very thin, right? During left ventricular systole, the mitral leaflets do not close normally and blood is ejected into the left atrium as well as the aortic valve. Those with mitral regurgitation lack early warning signs and may remain asymptomatic until severe and often irreversible left ventricular dysfunction occurs. So you can see it here where, you know, this is normal where, you know, when the pressure inside the left ventricle goes up, it closes this valve and away we go into the aorta. When we have mitral valve regurgitation, we can see here that, again, as left ventricular pressure rises, we do get some blood that goes off into the aorta, but we also get a backflow here that maintains some level of blood into it. And you can see it here in the top left picture as well. It's kind of squirting up and out through the hole. Prolapse, this is a common disease with frequent complications. It basically occurs in 2 to 3% of normal adults, especially young women, and most often detected during pregnancy. Men seem to have a higher incidence of complications if they do have it. There is a slight variation in the shape and the structure of the mitral valve. It is an anatomic and physiological abnormality of the mitral valve. Sort of the leaflets just don't kind of sit properly. They have an issue. The variation of shape allows one part of the valve or leaflet to billow back into the left atrium, during contraction of the ventricles. Normally, any amount of blood that leaks back is not significant. It's all more about the leaflet kind of expanding like an umbrella. In some cases, get regurgitation. More than 50% are asymptomatic. Another 40% experience occasional symptoms that are mild to moderate, and only 1% will suffer severe. In women, it doesn't really start showing up until you get pregnant, and that's when they start to notice it. Most common triad of symptoms is profound fatigue, palpitations, and dyspnea. So we can see it here that we get this normal, the leaflets close nicely. We can see how these are extending up into the atrium here in the prolapse, and then you get the prolapse with the regurgitation where the tips of the valves just don't quite seat properly, and you get a slight bit of a leak there. Aortic stenosis is a disease of aging. Usually get progressive valvular calcification, either superimposed on a congenitally bicuspid valve or the older adult as a result of previous rheumatic fever. So you actually get calcification of the leaflets of the valve. The aortic valve calcification is associated also with low-density lipoprotein C-related genetic variants. If you remember, LDL-C is also involved in atherosclerosis. So there's a correlation here where possibly someone will have valvular issues here with calcification of the leaves of the aortic valve. Risk factors are the same for those with heart disease. More than 80% of affected patients are men, so it's very much a men's disease. usually asymptomatic until the sixth decade or later. And you can, because you've got hard calcification, you'll hear clicking on auscultations when it moves. And you can see it here. You can see how calcified this is. Right? It should be nice and soft, but you can see all these hard edges on it. Aortic regurgitation, this is this used to be the result of previous rheumatic fever, but with the discovery of antibiotics, you don't see it quite so much anymore. Non-rheumatic causes account for most cases today as a result of congenitally different bicuspid valves, infective endocarditis, and hypertension. It can occur secondary to aortic dissection, ankylosing spondylitis, Reiter's syndrome, collagen vascular disease, syphilis, or Marfan syndrome. And some of these you'll get into in some of your other pathology classes. So when systole ends, of course, the aortic valve should completely prevent backflow of blood into the left ventricle. But what happens with this, you get leakage during diastole, or this aortic regurgitation or aortic insufficiency where you get blood back down into the left ventricle. So you can sort of see it here in the diagram. Pulmonary valve stenosis and regurgitation. It's the least common valve to have abnormalities. Usually, if you do, it's a congenital malformation, and usually this is the physician listening to your chest and saying, you have a murmur, let's do some workup and see what's going on here, and then it generally tends to be found. And you can see there are variations of what it may look like here. You can see them. Rheumatic fever. It's one form of endocarditis caused by the streptococcal group A bacteria that can be fatal or may lead to rheumatic heart disease. Where do you find this? Where do you find it? In your throat. Strep throat. Strep throat. Strep throat, if it's not treated properly, can lead to rheumatic fever. This is why you got a bad sore throat. The test is easy. They do a swab, and right there, and they can tell you whether or not you have strep throat and be treated for strep throat with antibiotics because, for some strange reason, strep loves valves. Likes eating them and destroying them. So you want to definitely deal with strep throat. This causes a chronic disease caused by scarring and deformity of the heart valves. It's called rheumatic fever because the two most common symptoms are fever and joint pain. Hence the reason why it was called that. Usually starts with strep throat in children between the ages of 5 and 15 and damages the heart in approximately 50% of the cases. But because of antibiotics now, we don't see this like we used to at all. At all. So it's really diminished. It's not as common as we saw. But in low and middle income countries where antibiotics are not quite as available, there still is a significant amount. So it's not well understood, the pathogenesis, but what happens is you have a strep infection, T cells get activated, B cells also get activated, producing antibodies against the bacterial infection. The streptococcal cell components have some similar similarities to the host body proteins, and the T cells start infiltrating the tissues, and the antibodies start binding the proteins on the heart, brain cells, muscles, and joints, which starts an autoimmune response. And basically rheumatic fever is considered an autoimmune disease. And that was a big thing for me. I didn't realize that until a couple of years ago. Inflammation affects the valve tissue in the myocardium. You get endocardial inflammation, which then results in swelling of the leaflets of the valve, secondary erosion along with lines of the leaflet where they can contact. You get these small bead-like clumps of vegetation containing vibrant and platelets that are deposited on this eroded valvular tissue, and also the chordae tendinae. And over time, scarring and shortening occur and the leaflets adhere to each other as the valves lose elasticity and the chordae tendinae can harden and rupture. And therefore, the valves will flip around and not function properly. How many slides have we got left? How many slides do we have left? Six, okay. So pericarditis and cardiac tamponade. I kind of alluded to that a little bit. So inflammation of the pericardium, and can it be a primary condition or secondary to a number of diseases? And have a look at the box on 607. It can occur as a single event or become chronic. Most are associated to drugs and the presence of an autoimmune disease, such as systemic lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. It can also occur after a heart attack, as part of renal failure, after open heart surgery, or radiation therapy. Many causes affect both the pericardium and the myocardium with varying degrees of dysfunction. Of course, it makes sense, right? If you had inflammation and affected tissue, it's not going to function as well. In some cases, you get fibrotic thickening and adherent pericardium that compresses the heart, known as constrictive pericarditis. Remember, right, the pericardium is on around the outside of the heart, and if it gets thickened and tight, the heart's going to feel the squeeze. When fluid accumulates within this pericardial sac, it is referred to as pericardial effusion. As this accumulation of fluid occurs, it fills the sac and compresses the heart. Remember, the heart has nowhere to go. It's completely surrounded by these tissues, right? So the path of least resistance, if you have fluid accumulation, is to squeeze the heart to make more room. This is known as cardiac tamponade, and it reduces ventricular filling and reduces cardiac output, and if not treated, can lead to death. Pain can refer to the neck, shoulders, upper back, upper trapezius, left supraventricular area or epigastrium, or down the left arm, and can on occasion result in fever, joint pain, dyspnea, or difficulty swallowing. So these folks with pericarditis, they also come in the hospital thinking they're having a massive heart attack, okay, because it feels just like it. Classic sign is pericardial friction rub heard on auscultations. So not unlike pleurisy, if this pericardium gets inflamed, before it starts to fill with fluid, it gets dry. Imagine every single heartbeat's like scraping sandpaper. That's why it hurts. So you can see it here. You get the inflammation, and then eventually the sac can fill up with fluid and then squeeze the heart. And as Sunil and I were talking about, the physician will stick a needle in here with a big syringe and suck all that fluid out. And it's a big needle. And it's not like in the movies. They don't go this way. They go up under here. Up, yeah. But yeah, you see it in the movies. It's like... Yeah. Have you? Yeah, I don't know. Right. The one lady that we did do the one time, he just nicked it just enough, and he pulled the fluid out, and it was nice. And then I left and went home, and then she ended up going down to South Lake because she had cardiac tamponade with blood, not with, so they had to go in and open her up and deal with it. So aneurysms. It's abnormal stretching, dilation of the wall of an artery or vein, or the heart with a diameter that is at least 50% greater than normal. When a vessel wall becomes weakened from trauma or congenital vascular disease, infection, or atherosclerosis, you end up with a permanent sac-like formation that develops. Remember, arteries are under high pressure, right? And they have the big, thick walls to deal with it. You get a weakening of that, then all of a sudden that pressure is going to start pushing against and create, shall we say, a balloon on the outside. There also is the possibility of dissection. Now, dissection is the disruption of the tunica media of the vessel wall with bleeding that occurs within and along the wall that results in the wall layers actually separating, individualizing, and getting fluid between them, usually blood, that starts peeling them all away. What's the potential for a clot there? Really, really high. And if it's in the aorta, great big huge freaking clots. You get various types, arterial and venous, and they're named according to the site. The most common arterial site is the aorta, either forming a thoracic aortic aneurysm above the diaphragm or an abdominal aortic aneurysm located below the diaphragm, and that is the most common. Triple A's are very, very common, and they're very genetic. And if you know someone in your family who has one, please get tested because they're potential is quite high. Peripheral arterial or aneurysms affect the femoral and popliteal arteries. And then, of course, we can get intracranial or cerebral aneurysms that affect cerebral arteries or veins. So you get intracranial aneurysms that occur in about 0.2 to 10% of the population, quite often called berry aneurysms, because when you look at them, they look like little berries kind of hanging on a stick. 50 to 80% of all intracranial aneurysms do not rupture in a lifetime. I had to have an MRI done on my head a few years ago, and everything's fine. But the doctor said, you get two for one here. And I said, why? He goes, well, the other thing they always check for is aneurysms to see when they do an MRI in the head. And he said, you haven't got any. I'm like, that's good. 200,000 in the U.S. are diagnosed with aortic abdominal aneurysms annually, and 14,000 are serious enough to rupture and cause death, which takes approximately 30 seconds. If it's a big one, it doesn't take very long if it goes. Right. Atherosclerosis or any injury to the middle layer of the arterial walls is responsible for most of them, and age is one of the most significant risk factors after age 50. You can get congenital weakness of the blood vessel walls that can contribute to it. These occur more often in men than in women. Women have a greater risk of rupture. Cigarette smoking increases the risk of aneurysm sevenfold. That's a lot. You know what a fold is? Yeah. 7 times 100. I guess it really increases the potential. First-degree family members, such as parents, adult, child, or sibling of anyone with an aneurysm have a 20% increased risk of a AAA. Thoracic aortic aneurysms account for approximately 10%, and anything that weakens the walls can result in an aneurysm formation. So you have a loss of elastic fibers in the walls, for example, or atherosclerotic plaque formation can cause it as well. Plaque formation that weakens the wall and increases the possibility of dissecting aneurysm. So rather than having the big balloon, if you have these plaque formations, it weakens the wall and blood can sort of tear in and get behind a layer and open it up and split it about. With each heartbeat, the dissection can extend further and further. So this is an actual ultrasound of a dissecting abdominal aortic aneurysm. So this should be a nice straight down abdominal aorta that bifurcates into the femoral, and this is approximately your belly button is approximately where the aorta bifurcates to go to each leg. But you can see here how large this is, started to become quite bulbous. And of course, being that large, the wall gets thinner. It's under high pressure. The potential of it going kabloom is pretty high. Aneurysms can be asymptomatic, but when they occur, manifestations are largely influenced by the size and where it is and its rate of growth. Dissections can be experienced with extreme sharp pain felt at the base of the neck or along the back into the interscapular area. And what's happening is, as it said, every single heartbeat increases pressure and it just keeps driving and splitting those layers farther apart as it works its way down. With a abdominal aorta, expansion and rupture can occur in one of several places, including the peritoneal cavity, the mesentery, the retroperitoneum, the vena cava, and the duodenum or the rectum. The rupture refers to the tearing of all three layers of the vessel, but the most common site for AAA is at the aortic bifurcation. That's where it generally tends to happen. Early warning signs can include a pulsating mass in the abdominal cavity when lying down, dull ache in the mid-abdominal region. Rupture is likely to occur when the aneurysm becomes greater than 5 centimeters in diameter, which causes intense flank pain, and I've seen it. One thing the patient did that my understanding is fairly common is they draw. So they literally draw their knees up to their abdominal wall, increasing intra-abdominal pressure, which pushes on the aneurysm and reduces pain. The guy was doing it all the time, just kept drawing his knees to his chest all the time. And he was lucky. He didn't burst, and he got in and got the sleeve put in. And he was one of our orderlies back in the day when we still had orderlies. Annual examination to ensure early identification is recommended for family members of anyone who's previously been diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm. So here's our dissection that we can see here. The blood is coming down and splitting the layers, as we can see the part of the tunica media and tunica intima kind of splitting away and tearing away. We can see here at the dissection, we can see it's starting to go, and then it starts to split all the way down. So there's some here at the top. Occasionally, they can get quite large. These are definitely a medical emergency as well. And I don't think they're as treated as well as a AAA, are they? Because of where they are. Yes. Here you can see how significant they can get. So in the dissection, you can see here you've got the false lumen full of blood and the true lumen here. Under normal circumstances, you would have it here. And then, of course, here's your abdominal aortic aneurysm here at the bifurcation. Whew. I think cardiac's done. I wanted to get that done today so badly. I know it was fast. And for those who weren't here, too bad. Thanks for staying. Yes, Crestor. And I specifically said that in class.